Welcome to Sci-Fi on Screen, the podcast that goes where no podcast has gone before. We here at Sci-Fi on Screen take a deep, close look at your favorite genre movies of science fiction, horror, fantasy, and comic book land. We go deep, scene by scene. We do comparisons of originals and remakes, and special shows. Just ahead, a new episode. And thanks for listening. Welcome back to another episode. This week is the second of a two-part lead-up to Batman v Superman Dawn of Justice, which opens today. Last week I covered Tim Burton's Batman film. This week I'm going to be doing an original versus remake comparison of Donner's Superman, which was done in 1978, and Zack Snyder's Man of Steel. Before I get to the comparison, I want to do a little feedback. I wanted to just thank Jason Strong. Jason is the latest Patreon pledger. Thank you, Jason. Got your pledge notification the other day. Really, really appreciate it. Folks don't know about Patreon. It's a way you can pledge a donation episode by episode. You can do as little as a dollar. It helps to defray costs. And, you know, I have this crazy idea that maybe someday this would be profitable where I could do this for a living. And there's another podcast concerning action movies that I'd like to do to start up again. So any pledge you make would kind of be towards that goal as well. So thanks, Jason, for that. Now, I appreciate the feedback I got from Jason in general via Twitter. We talked about one of his requests about a RoboCop episode, and I think I have an original versus remake in the works a couple months from now, so got that in the pipeline. I also want to thank user JCheck on Twitter. Gave a nice shout-out on Twitter for me, loving the podcast. Thanks so much, JCheck. I saw your requests. Let's see what I can do about it. Also, thanks to Glenn Acklin. Glenn and I have been corresponding a little bit via the scifionscreen@gmail.com email address. Turned me on to a film I never heard of called Idaho Transfer. So got that on my list to take a look at. Not sure if I'm going to podcast it, but obscure sci-fi film, that's my bag, baby. Once again, thanks to Hedge Knight 84 and Space Cowboy Sci-Fi for retweeting my Martian podcast, as well as user LKD. Always appreciate when folks retweet, gets the word out. So thanks to everyone for listening, for tweeting, for retweeting, for liking. Really appreciate all the feedback that I get. Let's get to the comparison. Again, I'm going to be taking a look at Richard Donner's 1978 Superman film and comparing it to Zack Snyder's Man of Steel, which came out a couple of years ago. I'm trying to break this up. The films are roughly parallel, except for the, you know, sort of the third acts where Donna Superman goes into this Lex Luthor plot. Of course, Zack Snyder's Man of Steel gets into the General Zod stuff, which actually doesn't occur in the original series until the second film. So it's not really one-on-one the last third of the film, but I'll track them and just kind of give my spiel on what I think regardless. Let me start with 1978 film. So we open with the credit sequence, which is so rare these days that, you know, films really just kind of open now. You know, we don't really get the opening credits. It's funny, when you watch films back in like the 40s and 50s, you'd get what amounts to almost the closing credits nowadays and the opening credits, like full-on key grip and dolly grip and all these, yeah, before the movie even started. And things have changed so much now where we just jump in and all that stuff comes at the end. So one thing definitely I realized during the opening credits is, as much as to me, John Williams, I feel like he is such a key figure in modern cinema because, I mean, he was behind Jaws and Star Wars and Indiana Jones, all these seminal films that kind of broke open the blockbuster era. And I think really these films were, Williams' contribution to these films was integral to their success, especially Star Wars. He comes up with this incredible theme for Superman, you know, like just so indelible. We know it right away. To my mind, having been a casual Superman reader growing up, I wasn't a huge comics fan growing up, but, you know, a casual Superman reader, saw the 50s TV show reruns with George Reeves a little bit, you know, got the sense of what Superman stood for as the character. As I think, you know, most people can, even if they dip in casually, you know, you get a sense of what he's about. And I feel like John Williams' theme is just so perfect. It's such a wonderful evocation of that ethos of Superman in musical form. So just a wonderful, wonderful introduction. Before you even see a frame of the film, you know, you're emotionally just so prepped by him. So it's really, really wonderful opening. We see the red sun of Krypton. We look at, and Krypton is basically a, Krypton kind of looks like the Antarctic. It's a bunch of sort of these crystal islands with these domed cities. Very kind of cool looking. I love the Fortress of Solitude production design, which starts on Krypton, you know, where it's just, in a sense, these long shards kind of intersecting with each other, and it forms the main production design look of Krypton as well, and later, obviously, the Fortress of Solitude. It's just such a cool design. The crystallography being their computers, you know, where they use crystals to do stuff, which, you know, if you think about what they're trying to do now with memory and Blu-ray, getting, you know, lattices, kind of three-dimensional lattices for memory storage, like, kind of cool that, you know, they kind of threw that idea up in terms of crystals back in 1978. So really neat. To me, Donner's Superman, what it's set up in the genre is getting really good actors to be in comic book movies. Like Marlon Brando opened Superman, you know, like holy, back then, what a huge deal. It signaled a whole new, the beginning of a whole new approach to comic book films. To just see Marlon Brando open up a Superman film. I mean, think about that. Think about, you know, Jack Nicholson, in a sense, in Batman, Ian McKellen, Patrick Stewart in X-Men. Definitely, you know, a sense of really, you know, getting really great actors to be in comic book films starts here, you know. And to me, it's really great because he's not mugging for the camera. He's Brando, man. He's great. And really grounds the film initially. The film kind of goes haywire before it ends, but it grounds it in this kind of actorish realism, which was really great. So we briefly get that Jor-El is the prosecutor in the trial of Zod, Non, and Ursa. Basically, these two films, Superman 1 and 2, were planned to be filmed concurrently. They were going to shoot all of the footage and then edit it into two films. So you're getting this trial, which is going to set up for Superman 2, obviously. There's a great effect here where the jury that they're being tried around are these giant faces projected on screens all around them. And it's a really kind of sinister and cool look to things, you know, like, so already you've got Brando, you've got these faces, the sound is on, there's an echo in the chamber, like straight away, like it's really given a great start. And then these cool effects where the prison that they're standing under, these two kind of undulating circles that are undulating back and forth, you know, I guess creating some kind of a force field holding them in, just kind of a neat production design, you know. And there's a great scene after they're prosecuted where the dome opens up. And this the scale of the dome opening is really amazing. And then they're beamed up into what basically amounts to a square of crystal glass of some kind, which is the Phantom Zone. It's kind of hokey, you know. This kind of tumbling square of glass appears over the dome. They're beamed up into it, and then the glass keeps going, and we see their faces in the glass kind of, you know, help, get us out of here. You know, a little bit hokey, but, you know, it is what it is. So then we get another cool thing, which is, you know, the S on Jor-El's chest, when he's facing off against a bunch of other the leaders of the council, they all have different symbols on their chest, which is really cool. So that S is the sort of the symbol of the House of Jor-El, which is kind of cool. And he lays out that in 30 days, Krypton is going to be destroyed. And of course, none of them believe him. They shoot the costumes. They must be wearing some kind of really shiny, like aluminum foil or something. And they must have lights on it because it's, they're all wearing like this shiny white clothing. That's really cool looking, actually. It's, you know, it's, you can probably say it's a little dated, but I don't know. It's a very subtle little effect that I think I really like. Of course, you know, there's a brief preparation for Kal-El's departure, and Jor-El and Lara are there, and there's this wonderful sense of like, you know, we're going to send you on to great things, son. It's more of like a tonal preparation. There's really not much plot here. This is the classic Superman origin story. Jor-El telling his people that the planet's doomed. They think he's full of shit. He sends his son off to safety. And it's cool. The ship is this kind of crystal star construction, which is really neat. Not what you kind of would expect, you know, for a starship in a 1978 film. So very cool. Krypton is destroyed. The ship escapes. The effects are kind of very dated. And as he's traveling, you know, it's almost like he's getting a books on tape version of Jor-El educating him. So we get a little bit of a montage of when he's traveling, and we hear Jor-El's voiceover like, humans are this, giving him a little bit of a, you know, history lesson and where he's going. So we realize that, you know, Superman's got a little more smarts than, you know, he may be known for. And we also hear that And this is a setup for the ending of this film, which is, you know, very much in contention by most fans. And he is forbidden to interfere with human history. And that's Jor-El's dictate. He's like, you know, you can do what you want. You can help them. You can be a shining beacon of this or that, but you cannot interfere with their history, which, you know, that's kind of a weird thing. And then because everything he does would interfere. But maybe they mean that he can't interfere politically, you know, that he can't mess around with nation states and dictate the course of that history either. But of course, this is obviously a setup to the, you know, the time travel ending, as it were. So that's the original film. Now I'm going to jump to Man of Steel. We open straight away with Kal-El's birth. A pretty intense scene. Very similar overtones to the original with Marlon Brando as Russell Crowe, who definitely, you know, gives Brando a run for his money. Russell Crowe, immediately, we're taking this whole thing seriously. Crowe's amazing. I think there's an Israeli actress named Ayelet Zurer who plays his wife. Age appropriate, thank God. Looks, you know, they look of the same age, not a 20-year-old wife. We get the first hint of Hans Zimmer's theme, which is going to run through a lot of Man of Steel. And I have to say, as much as, you know, I love Williams, Zimmer gives him a run for his money. And, you know, Zimmer's operating from a new school where his themes aren't so much these classical melodies, but more you're getting a hint of a melody or a tone or just a series of notes. I mean, that's kind of how Zimmer works. He's much more elemental in terms of trying to create an emotional feeling from the music, whereas Williams is an old school theme guy, you know, what they call the leitmotif that comes from Wagner. I'm a little biased with Zimmer because I think he's brilliant and I love most of the soundtracks that he does. So, but he comes up with this really beautiful, incredible, inspiring theme for Superman that we get straight away. You know, it's really beautiful. So, you know, definitely giving Williams a run for his money. You know, I wouldn't say better, but I would say different and equally as powerful in terms of giving you an emotional sense of what Superman is about. Now, there's a whole difference here. Like, there's a whole plot, and Krypton is so much more realized in terms of CGI and world building. There's a lot more action in this setup. We're getting this whole General Zod insurrection subplot, which is only told to Kal-El in the original film. You know, it's told to him by sort of the artificial intelligence of Jor-El in the Fortress of Solitude, but here we see it. So while Jor-El is instructing the council about the instability of Krypton, Zod and his crew bust in and they take over the planet and they take the council hostage. And the thing is here, you know, the problem I have with this is so much action straight away. And we really don't have any idea what Zod's whole thing is about. We hear something about that he wants to be the one to determine what types of humans are born on Krypton or what types of Kryptonians. You know, so we're set up that the Kryptonians are born kind of like the Matrix. They're grown. Where Kal-El was like the first natural birth human, which is for a long time. And I think, you know, Jor-El alludes to the fact that it's quite illegal. And I guess Zod wants to take over this process and control it, you know, do some selective genetics and control who's born, what type of people are born, which, I don't know, whatever. In this day and age, it doesn't really make me feel anything towards Zod. It's a really stock kind of comic booky thing that, I don't know, it doesn't really jive. I don't really get off on it so much. Jor-El is taken hostage, but there's some sympathetic droid with him and he fights his way out of it. So basically Jor-El in this one is as much of an action hero, even in the main action as a hologram later on, as Kal-El is, you know, like I wonder if Russell Crowe put it in his contract. So he fights his way out of captivity. And then we get a full-on widescreen SF war scene. You know, Zod's forces against the Krypton's forces. Very Zack Snyder style. Lots of lens flares. Jor-El rides this winged beast. And he gets something called a codex. And basically, this codex is a record of all the Kryptonians that are to be born. So basically, they're, you know, the way they're born is this machinery for birthing humans with a cool, I guess, a Genesis chamber. It reads in the codex who's next to be born. And I guess somehow, at this point, maybe it's random, but the codex contains a genetic outlook for the Kryptonian people. And it reads the codex and then creates human beings based on the codex. So, you know, there's this whole story. Like, it's too much story to start with. And it later on, it doesn't really play into the movie. So, in a way, it's just like it's a lot to take when you're coming into this movie. you know, it's in this water chamber, so Jor-El has to dive into it and swim and gets the codex. And, you know, there's so much money on the screen. There's so much going on. But, you know, I'm not really emotionally involved in what's happening here. You know, I'm just kind of nodding my head like, okay, look, there's a lot of action, but there's not a lot of emotional involvement, which I always think is Zack Snyder's Achilles heel, unfortunately. So then, you know, he gets the codex. He goes back to, you know, House Jor-El, and they're getting ready to send Kal-El in the ship. So we get a little bit of him and Lara. She doesn't, you know, and they milk it. It's very melodramatic. Lara, like at the last minutes, like doesn't want to send him, and Jor-El does. And then the codex is sent with Kal. Now we see him put the codex is basically this little skull, and it kind of transmutes into some kind of form around Kal-El. We're not really sure. All we do see at the end of it is a slim little rod with an S on the tip of it, and we get a sense that the codex has been, like, transmuted, but it's kind of a bait and switch that happens up later. So Zod arrives, and now there's this whole thing of, like, I thought you'd understand, Jor-El, and, you know, you're a maniac. So there's a last battle. They fight. And Michael Shannon as Zod is good. Like, he's a little stiff. He's a little wooden. He's got some charisma, but the character is kind of a megalomaniac, and there's no way in to really get into him. Like, think about a character like Magneto. Like, I completely understand Magneto and where he's coming from in the X-Men films, and there's nothing like that here with Zod. He's a stock comic book villain, and not that interesting. When Zod finds out that Kal-El's been born from natural birth, he flips out, and as an audience member, I have no idea why. And this kind of level of tension is usually reserved for the end of a film, when you have an emotional investment of like 2 hours plus of building up to it. But this level of tension so early on, and we're not really invested. No one really gets a sense of why Zod's so bent on control. And so it's just a lot of stuff going on. They milk the tension about the ship launching, like Laura won't commit yet. And as the ship is taking off, Jor-El and Zod are fighting. And of course, Zod kills Jor-El. The ship launches, and then at that point, we see that the Kryptonian forces have gained supremacy, and Zod is overthrown. We hear that he's sentenced to, quote, 300 cycles of somatic reconditioning. We don't hear anything about something called the Phantom Zone, but we do get a tag that before they, you know, they're in these, like, cocoons, right? So before they're put in these cocoons, you know, him screaming, I will find him, or I will find his progeny, whatever, so whatever. So we see them go into this giant ship. You know, what looks like, you know, a Phantom Zone is created, the ship slips into it, and it closes, so us in the know realize it's kind of the Phantom Zone thing, but they don't say Phantom Zone. And then we get the destruction of Krypton, which, of course, is done beautifully, as is, you know, 2015 or 2014, you know, sci-fi, very beautifully done. And we get the transit of Kal-El's craft and the landing on Earth. Comparison. Basically, the original film, I like it better, and here's why. All they're doing is setting up, in a sense, it's kind of a thematic setup. This is where Kal-El comes from. He's from a dying race. And there's just really the sense of his father saying, you're going to be a god amongst them. They can be a good people. You know, there's a philosophical underpinning to what Superman is going to be. And I think that's all you need here. There's a dignity about everything here. I mean, you know, Russell Crowe's great, but I mean, Brando is Brando. So there's something about the dignifying presence of Brando and the fact that they keep it simple. Krypton's going to be destroyed and Kal-El's going to... I like it, you know, whereas Man of Steel, it's so plot heavy and there's so much story. You know, there's a lot of daring do. There's a lot of Jor-El, the action hero, running around and laser blasts and incredible widescreen vistas and lens flares up the wazoo. And to me, it takes away from what should be really... We kind of forget about Kal-El with all this whole Jor-El, you know, Zod politics and all this action. It pulls away from what I think should be the sort of the spiritual foundation of Superman, which is what, you know, his father and mother are going to imbue him to be. And there's just so much action. And I mean, this bloody Man of Steel is so long. I feel like you don't need half of this. I mean, when Zod, Ursa, and Nan come to Earth in Superman 2 in the original film, like once the action starts, it's like he's just a bad guy out for power. And you don't need all this backstory that said he fought against this thing and he wants this and he doesn't want that. And I could care less, you know. So to me, all of this CGI and all this money and all this action, this widescreen destruction, it's kind of a waste of time. You know, I don't marvel at it. You know, when I go back to rewatch Man of Steel, I usually fast forward past it because it's kind of BS. So I prefer the focus and the dignity of the original and what they did with the character. And it's a little more powerful to me. Whereas, you know, when the Krypton sequence in the remake ends, like, I'm exhausted already. And I'm just like, all right, what happened here? Is any of that going to matter? So on and so forth. So yeah, so that's how I kind of come down. All right, so the next sequence I'm going to talk about and compare is Smallville, so The Youth of Superman. I'll start with the 78 film. We get Glenn Ford, the actor, and actress named Phyllis Thaxter as the Kents in the original film. They get right to it. They're driving in a truck down an isolated Kansas lane, and they witness the fall of Kal-El spacecraft. We see this naked boy climbing out, full frontal boy nudity. Like, you're not going to see that too much anymore, you know, kind of interesting. You know, they take the little boy with them, and we instantly get the understanding about what Superman is on this new world when they're changing a flat tire and sort of the jack falls and little Kal-El holds up the truck. It's a beautiful little moment, very simple. And the camera kind of looks, pans over to look at the crashed ship and then look back at Clark. And it's like, you know, okay, you know, we know visually what's going on here, which I really like. They flash forward quickly to Clark as a high schooler. You know, they do the classic dramatic thing of like Clark is bullied a lot. He's the water boy on the football team. One odd thing here is Christopher Reeve is overdubbing the actor's lines. So there's something a little kind of removed about it. But, you know, basically Lana Lang wants Clark to come hang out. But, you know, he's got water boy duty, so he can't. And we get a bit of the outsider vibe here, which they really do to much better effect in Man of Steel. But, you know, that he really kind of has to watch himself or risk outing who he is. But we get this wonderful, exuberant scene of when Lana takes off with all the football team from Smallville. You know, Clark races off, and the next scene is him racing a train, which is just amazing. John Williams' music cues up. The effects of him running are not that great, you know, per 1978 effects, but it's really exuberant, you know, the smile on his face and the soundtrack, and you really, really are filled up with that sense of, you know, wonder at you know, Superman, the character. And there's this funny little cameo here on the train. We cut to this family looking out of the window, and there's a little girl on the train, and you know, she sees Clark running at super speed. And of course, when she tries to get the family to look, he's gone. In the film, that character is Lois Lane and her parents. And the actors playing Lois's parents, Kirk Allen and Noelle Neal, these two character actors played Superman and Lois Lane in the film serials back in the 40s. And Noelle Neal actually reprised her role in the 1950 Superman with George Reeve. So got a whole bunch of actors intermingling here, which is really kind of cool. And one thing I have to say about the Smallville, the Kansas stuff, is Richard Donner's cinematography. He really widescreens us out here, man. It's just some beautiful shots of Kansas, a lot of big shots, big open shots of the fields and prairie. And it's really beautiful, you know, really beautiful. And it really, to me, help kind of sets the mood here of like this kind of the simplistic lifestyle, these, you know, solid stock of people, really great. And we get a brief conversation, you know, right before basically Jonathan Kent dies about his powers, you know, that you're here for a reason and it's not to score touchdowns, you know. So he's trying to hold Clark back from a quick and easy use of his powers. But then we get some real tragedy here in that his father dies of a heart attack. And his last words are very poignant. And it's Clark's first taste of death. You know, like all that he can do, all of his powers, and he couldn't save his dad. And unfortunately, they totally go against this at the end of the film. Because it's a moment where I think it could really, you know, Superman to me is so hard to do as a character in any medium because he's so bloody powerful. It's so hard to make us feel empathy for him or put him under real danger where we don't think he's going to get out of it. No, it's always, and he's such a, you know, his character is so cornbread that it's just so hard to milk drama out of it. And I feel like this is a perfect way to do it. This juxtaposition of like, even though he's almost omnipotent in power, like he can't stop his father from dying and maybe how that would play out going forward, but they don't capitalize on it, which is kind of a bummer. But it's a very solid thing. Before he leaves to go to Smallville, he goes into the barn and he's face to face with his past. He pulls up this green crystal, which came out of his ship, and he says goodbye to his mom. And there's this great departure scene where they're both standing on the prairie, and you know we're seeing the expanse of Kansas behind them. And he's like, "Mom, I have to go." And she's like, "I know you do." And you know they don't milk it too much with melodrama. You know she kind of knows that that day was going to come when he was going to discover his birthright and so on and so forth. So really good. I really like the original film's treatment of his youth. It's a little brief and, you know, we don't get too much character depth, but there's something in it. There's something, the mood that they strike and the solemnity of the father's death. It's really good, and I really enjoy it. Now I'm going to move over to Man of Steel, and to me, this is what Man of Steel really gets right. You know, they pulled a lot of the theme from this part of Man of Steel from the Secret Origins, Superman Secret Origins comic book. I think Geoff Johns wrote it, that really tries to get into Superman's struggle being an outsider, having all these powers, and the difficulty of him, you know, fitting into human society, which I think is such a great, you know, they briefly brushed on it in the original, but I feel like that's it's a great source to make Superman an interesting character and have him be complex, to develop drama. And in Man of Steel, it's a little tricky because they intercut these scenes. It's very Batman Begins, where from the Krypton opening sequence, we cut to like Superman working on a fishing boat. And so he's working on a fishing boat, then he's, you know, he works in a diner. So from, and he's making his way to some ship in the north that's somehow he's drawn to. We don't really find out why, but, and during this brief journey, we get all the flashbacks to do his childhood, which is a lot like Batman Begins. And since Christopher Nolan, you know, produced this film, it makes sense that they would try to use a similar structure. So I'm going to cut out all the present stuff, and I'll get to that later, and just focus on the flashbacks of Smallville. It's so dynamite. The first time that we start with Clark in class, I think it's elementary school, and it's the first time that he experiences his X-ray vision, which is really cool, man. He's sitting in class, and he starts seeing through the skeletons of all the kids around him and the teacher, and like, you know, he's looking at them, and then all of a sudden he's seeing their skull and their muscular system, and it really freaks him out. And so at one point, he bursts out of class and runs and, you know, hides in a closet. And they have to call his mom, who's wonderfully played by Diane Lane, as Martha Kent. And there's a lovely soundtrack cue from Zimmer as she talks him out of the closet. Clark, you know, close your eyes and imagine, just focus on my voice and come out. So we really get, in a very brief sequence, you know, the bond between Clark and his mom, which is really amazing. And then we shift now when he's in like junior high, still being picked on, of course, you know, and they being a modern film, it's a little more soap opera-y. So you've got Pete Ross sort of like, I want to hear what Clark thought of the game. And Lana Lang like, leave him alone, Pete. So, you know, they push it a little bit, but not for very long. The bus that they're on winds up crashing into this river, and Clark pushes it out, and we get, again, Hans Zimmer music in all of this, which is amazing. We see Lana and I think Pete, they turn around and they see Clark actually pushing the bus out of the riverbed, which is really kind of cool. And we cut to then Pete and his mom at, you know, at the Kent house saying, this is not the first time Clark's done something like this. We saw what he did. And now we get a scene between Clark and his dad, played by Kevin Costner, who's, again, perfect casting, I think. You know, we get this, and this is a really beautiful scene. He's telling him to his son, like, you've got to keep part of yourself a secret because, you know, you don't know about how people are going to react to you. And, like, you know, you've just got to keep this to yourself. At that point, he brings him into the barn and shows him the craft that he arrived in. And we get, you know, the explanation about who he is. And I love that in this moment, young Clark kind of cries. He's like, I don't know about all this stuff. I can't just keep pretending that I'm your son. Jonathan comes over and like, of course you're my son. Like, it gets me every time. Like, it's a great, great emotional moment, you know, really very powerful. I always like, God, I wish that somehow this theme could continue into the film and we don't have to have like, you know, the Galactus fight at the end, which I'm calling it the Galactus fight. But anyway, really great scene. Okay, so the next we meet young Clark in his very late teens, maybe even early 20s. It's our first glimpse of actor Henry Cavill, who is Superman Clark Kent in this film, who I really like. I think it was a great choice. I think he's a really good actor. And, you know, he's getting antsy and rebellious about his future. He's riding in the truck with his father and his mother, and he's pushing, you know. He's like, you're not my father, and, you know, maybe you don't know what's best for me. At that point, we Twisters hit. This is Kansas, and there are Twisters. It's a nice little add to the Superman mythos, right? That there's a Twister incident. And of course, you know, we're rescuing people. There's a nearby overpass, right? And all the people are going under there to hide. And so there's this moment where the father and, you know, and Clark, and he's like, you take your mother, I'll go get the dog, right? Of course, the father goes and gets the dog, who's rescued. Then Clark is looking on as the father turns, not even trying to escape the Twister, right? I understand, again, what they're getting at is, like, sometimes it's all Clark can do. Like, there's nothing he could do. And I like in the first film where they explored this, but this one was, it's a little too stagey, where if I'm a film goer and I'm looking at Kevin Costner on the screen, and I'm like, you know, he probably could have ran over to his family and pretty much escaped the Twister. But he stands there for, like, several beats and looks over at Clark, just so the filmmakers can punch up the emotional level of things. And I got to call bullshit on it because that's what it is. There's absolutely no reason why his father has to die in this way. And it's very much like Jor-El, like the father has, his father is a hero too. Like everyone's a hero in this movie. All the good guys are heroes. Jor-El's a hero. Jonathan Kent's a hero. It's like, it's too much, man. It's like, it's too much that he stands there and looks at Clark and Clark can't do like a super speed grab because it would go against what his father wanted. You know, he'd be discovered. And of course, which I get, and it makes a lot of sense, but there's just something about the scene that as soon as you see Jonathan Kent standing there, you're just like, it's bullshit. This is all done. But Cavill's reaction when he dies is amazing. Like, there's this incredible scream. He's got great eyes, Henry Cavill. So it's a really good reaction, but it's just a little melodramatic. So just to compare the two Smallville segments, the two films, I think it's the best part of both of these films is the Smallville sequences. I think, believe it or not, the remake does a better job at getting at the alienation. I think the X-ray scene is great. I like, you know, it's a little punched up, but I like that the kids are more against him. You know, it's very emotional that he can do all these things and he has to hold back. And there's the moment between young Clark and Costner when he said, I just want to pretend being your son. Like, they really get at this sense of alienation that he's going through, which I think is really powerful. It's a great part of the Man of Steel that I really like. So the original does a great job as well. And I got to say, like, this is definitely the high point of both films. But Man of Steel just does a little bit more with the material. So just want to take a quick minute to let you know a couple of ways you can support Sci-Fi on Screen. One way is to use Patreon. Patreon is a crowdfunding site that works by allowing users to contribute on a show-by-show basis. All you do is choose a dollar amount you want to contribute, and every time one of my podcasts appears, you'll be debited the amount you choose. You can donate as little as $1 per show. That's $4 a month or $52 a year. No obligation, and you can cancel or adjust the rate at any time. And the best part is it keeps me honest. If there's no show, there's no charge. And it would help to defray hosting costs and for my time to put the shows together. The link is on my website, top right-hand corner, and signing up at Patreon is a snap by clicking on Become a Patron. There's also a great way as if you would like to buy the Blu-ray copies of any of the movies that I've reviewed on my podcast. Just simply go to the website, click on the movie page, and go ahead and click on the Blu-ray below the podcast, and it'll take you right to Amazon. If you purchase it, I get a few bucks from that as well. And always appreciate it if you're on Twitter to retweet my podcast as they appear and spread the word. Now I want to compare the Fortress of Solitude moments in both films, right? In the original film, before we go to Metropolis, you know, Clark takes the green crystal and somehow, you know, gets all the way up to the Arctic, throws the crystal in the snow, and we get the creation of the Fortress of Solitude, which is really beautiful. It's a bit too long of a scene. It takes forever for him to get up there and him slowly exploring the space, but the lattice structure of it, again, the architecture is really, really cool. The full-on crystalline recording devices. And then we get an explanation that now there's going to be a 12-year gap in time. And during this 12 years, he's being educated on his past. He learns all about, you know, the three criminals, Jor-El, his mother and father, Krypton, and he's educated, you know, with the knowledge of the galaxy, as it were, you know, and his past and everything. So it's a little bit of Christology here. I sent them you, my only son. You know, there's definitely a little bit of the Christ mythos in this one, you know, that I've sent you my only son to lead them, they can be better kind of stuff. But it's not overly done, so I don't mind it at all. And it fits, right? At the end of this segment, you have Christopher Reeve striding out of the Fortress of Solitude in costume. So he emerges as Superman. And we do get, you know, the trope of Jor-El being an AI, which they keep in the new film. They do address directly, the film addresses the secret identity bit, where Jor-El advises him that you should go under an assumed name, because number one, and this is kind of cool, I think, in the original film, they're like, if you're just Superman all the time, like, then people are never going to stop asking you to do shit, basically, which is what Jor-El says. He's like, and they'll start asking you to do stuff that they could easily do for themselves. He's like, so that's, you know, one thing is overwork, which is kind of funny. And then the second one is that, you know, it's a way to protect your loved ones, because when we develop relationships on the planet, you know, you're going to be pretty inassailable as a supreme being. So they're going to go after the people you love and who you know. So I like that. I like that they address the secret identity bit with a very practical solution. So, you know, pretty decent. sequence. So the remake, Man of Steel, they don't really do the Fortress of Solitude so much. What happens is Clark discovers that the Kryptonians sent these seed ships to colonize planets all over the galaxy. And so he finds one of these seed ships that's been on Earth for like hundreds of thousands of years. And he brings it up to the Arctic and it becomes sort of his Fortress of Solitude. We see dead Kryptonians in the ship as well. So one thing that I think that Man of Steel doesn't really figure out is that, are we here on Earth the descendants of Kryptonians? Yes or no? Or did they crash land when that ship arrived? Did they crash land and die? So kind of left as a bit of a mystery. I don't know if it was on purpose or they just didn't think it through, but they do one great visual thing in A Man of Steel. Now, they do a lot of great visual things, but one of it is the technology, the visual technology that depicts certain things is done like this Art Deco kind of morphing gold bas-relief. So as Jor-El, the AI of Jor-El, is narrating the history of Krypton and the exploration of the galaxy, we're seeing it done in this sort of like gold bas-relief that keeps changing. It's really beautiful. It's a very clever touch that is just, you know, it's not your basic high tech. It's like low tech, high tech. The thing I don't like about this here is that the backstory about them colonizing the planets, like, it doesn't have anything to do with Zod or his whole thing. It's just like, again, it's just a lot more plot about why the ship is there. You know, obviously because they need that ship for, you know, more of the plot that's to come. But like, okay, yeah, he's the natural birth. We get the costume, which, you know, makes sense of sort of the clothing design of the Kryptonians, S being the symbol of hope, which is all great. But the whole colonizing backstory, like, it's cool. I like it. But again, you know, it doesn't play into unifying the film emotionally, which is where I think Man of Steel eventually fails. But I will save that for the recap. So at the end of this, like the first film, he emerges from the ship in his cape and outfit, and he's jumping first. We see him learning how to fly in this film, which we don't in the first film. And I think, if I'm correct, initially Superman in the comics could not fly. Like, he wasn't some being that could just fly. Like, he could jump really far. It was kind of like a Hulk. And eventually, he grew in the comics, like, his powers and strength grew eventually to where he could fly. Kind of like Wonder Woman, where I don't think she used to be able to fly, and now she can. I'm wondering if him jumping these long distances and then eventually flying is kind of like a thematic nod to how the character developed in the comics. I mean, I don't know, but it's kind of cool. And the flying sequences here are just, you know, completely blow away the original film. I mean, it's just years in technology. That's all it is. You know, not the original film did a great job with what it had. And I like actually the original film flying sequences when Superman is like just taking off or just landing anywhere because he's on wires and actually looks kind of cool because it's very realistic. Whereas, you know, the flying pretty much in the Zack Snyder Man of Steel is like, it's all CGI. It's great CGI, but there is a sense of the real actor being on wires in the first one that like gives some scenes a little more realism, but the chronic users are cool because now they get to do like, you know, Superman breaking the speed of sound and what a sound wave being broken looks like visually, you know, very cool, and how it affects atmosphere, him going through clouds and stuff like that. So it's really great. So again, of the two, you know, Fortress of Solitude scenes, you know, catch as catch can. I think, you know, it's kind of fun to find out in the new one about the Kryptonians and all the you know, the colonizing and all that. And the first one is just very simple. It's just, you know, it's allowing Superman to get to know who he is as a being. And the second one does that as well. So, you know, it's catch as catch can here. I think they both do a great job within their, you know, within their stories to set this up. So now, this is where the two films diverge. The original film, we get into kind of a two-part bit of the film now, where the first part is establishing Superman as Clark Kent at the planet and his emergence into Metropolis, and then we get the Lex Luthor plot and how that's going to impact Superman at the end. And then Man of Steel goes into the whole Zod Earth takeover plot. So they diverge wildly, so I can't compare them apples to apples. So I'll just do, you know, I'll kind of just break them out a little bit and talk about kind of how I feel about what each film does on its own. So again, we get the very traditional, in the original 78 Superman, very traditional story. You know, he arrives in Metropolis. He's an unknown kid. His first job is at the Daily Planet. We meet Lois Lane, played by Margot Kidder, Jimmy Olsen, P. Perry White. He gets the city beat. You know, there's a little bit of rivalry because it was Lois's and now he's got it. We get a bit of character. Half of his pay goes to his mother, which is good. His clumsy shtick, because, you know, Reeves is a big dude. There's a cameo by Rex Reed, which is kind of funny. And we get this scene of a mugger in an alley where Lois is very demonstrative and, like, she doesn't care that he has a gun. And he actually catches the bullet. It's a bit shticky, but, you know, it's kind of fun in a sense of, you know, without being too campy. We also are introduced to Lex Luthor by following his henchman Otis, played by Ned Beatty. And these two cops follow him in the subway, and they watch him disappear into like a doorway right on a main subway line. But as the one cop tries to follow Otis in, we see Luthor back in his lair, push a button, and he gets actually thrown in front of the train and dies. The introduction of Luthor, I mean, this is reminds me very much, and I say reminds me because this movie came first, but it's very similar to the Burton's Batman in that the villain is a bit sticky and a bit humorous. This is like Gene Hackman's Lex Luthor is like a funny Lex Luthor. You know, he has these idiot henchmen, Otis, Miss Tessmacher is his sort of, you know, girlfriend. Really, really goofy. Hey, Mr. Luthor, you know, with all kinds of shtick to it. And it is what it is. You either like it or you don't. You know, I tend to think that the rest of the film is a little unbalanced, kind of like Batman is too, where there's a very earnest side to Superman's story, but there's a very goofy side to Luthor's. So anyway, the first emergence of Superman into Metropolis is one of the best parts of the original film, I think. It's staged pretty well. Lois gets on a helicopter. There's a purely accidental accident. And as Clark is on the street looking up, it's funny that he runs into a phone booth. And it's, as of 1978, they were starting to have those new sort of half phone booths where they weren't full booths. You know, you stood in one, but it was all open. So I think that was kind of a nod and a wink at the audience right there, which was great. And then he goes into a revolving door, and I guess he spins so fast that he changes his clothes, which is like, okay, you know, it is what it is. But he winds up flying up, and he catches Lois in the helicopter. For whatever reason, as kooky as it kind of is, there's something thrilling about this scene. And I think it's the music to a lot of it, and I think it's the crowd's reaction at it as well. You know, they're all on the street looking up, and just Superman's emergence and the Williams score, like, and Reeves has a lot of charm here. There's just a really, it's like an interesting combination of things that all just work in a really old-fashioned way that I love, you know, and it's just really great. Just a, you know, one place, again, where I think the Donner film really shines is just this sequence of the helicopter, really great. So then we get a succession of Superman. Now he's on the case. He catches a jewel thief. There's a car chase where he catches some crooks on boats. He gets a cat out of a tree, which is kind of goofy. Air Force One of its engines is struck by lightning. He goes in the engine and becomes part of the engine, so kind of fun. And then we get the Daily Planet reaction, obviously Perry White. I want answers. And then Clark really kind of is falling for Lois. And so he gives her a card. She doesn't know what comes from him, but she's like, you know, meet later, a special friend. And Lois thinks, because Superman just saved her, that it's him. And obviously it is. So it's a really good scene because they play it pretty straight. Like, she has this beautiful apartment. There's like a rooftop penthouse. You know, she's all dressed up in this gown. He flies in and sits down. And Reeve is great. It's very direct. You know, she asks him all kinds of questions. He answers them very direct. It's really cool. And Kidder is good. She's very flustered at times. And other times, you know, she gets her head back and she really grills him with some questions. And the flying scene is what it is. I think it's an anachronism of the time. There's this song called Can You Read My Mind? And there's a part of the song where Margot Kidder is saying the lyrics, you know, and as if she's voicing over to herself. So it's about the cheesiest thing you've ever seen. You can't even start with the, you know, aerodynamic factor of how he's holding her, how they're flying together, and, you know, there's no wind and all that. But it is what it is, you know, like, it's hard to watch now. It's kind of really, really cheesy, and it goes on for a long time. It's almost like a little music video, and I wonder if John Peters got the party man idea from this part of Superman, because it is kind of, you know, it's the whole song and them flying and not much is going on. And when he leaves, she coins his name like, you're a Superman. So we get the naming of Superman as well. There's a knock at the door right after Superman leaves, and of course it's Clark with the glasses on. And, you know, this is the tough part. I think Man of Steel was very smart in avoiding this whole thing for the meantime, that, you know, it's the glasses thing is just so absurd. You know, depending on what your mood is as you're watching this movie, either swallow it or you don't. I think Reeve does a pretty good job, you know, with the mannerisms and slumping his shoulders and all that. But like, you know, the whole glasses shtick is just, it's really old shtick. So there you have it. Then we get, you know, now we get the beginnings of Luthor's plot, because obviously Luthor is now out to destroy Superman. Luthor is completely a non-character. I mean, he's just a villain. He's funny. He's shticky, but we don't really get any sense of how Luthor ticks. He's it's kind of a waste of Hackman, unfortunately. But so he, out of nowhere, he theorizes that pieces of Krypton floating through space would be deadly to Superman, which makes absolutely no sense at all. But we also are starting to get a sense of his plan. Luthor's, and it's again, it's very hijinky, where Luthor, and it's really just Luthor and Otis and Testmonger hijacking, not hijacking missiles, but they stage these little, you know, accidents that that slow up this missile convoy, and then while they're distracting the soldiers, you know, like one of them is Testmonger in a really bright gown, is passed out. Otis runs in and reprograms one of the missiles with a different set of targets. Okay, you know, it is what it is. It's really goofy. All of the stuff is really goofy. Then we start the story of bringing Lois out to the West. She's investigating sales of worthless land to an unknown buyer, which, you know, very convenient, but it is what it is. And then a really cool idea in the midst of all this is that Luthor draws Superman into his lair by using a frequency that he assumes only Superman can hear. Again, this is a hell of a stretch for Luthor. How would he even... He knows nothing about Superman, so, you know, how would he know that he could hear in a different spectrum? But it's a really cool thing regardless. So, I mean, for this movie, it's kind of fun. But so, of course, you know, Superman hones in on him underground, finds his lair. There are all these ridiculous traps, like a fire chamber, an ice chamber, an automatic weapons chamber. Like, ridiculous that he would have all these things underground in New York City. But, you know, we're still in pre-21st century comic book films here, so it is what it is. We cut during all this to the missile that they reprogrammed firing, and when Superman finally gets into the lair, Luthor explains his plan. And, of course, he's tricked Superman by placing kryptonite inside a lead-lined vault. So once he opens it, you know, it's a necklace, he puts it around his neck, throws him in a pool, so Superman's down for the count. And at the same time, we see Lois and Jimmy out near some dam out west, probably close to where the missile's going to hit. Then we get Miss Testmonger saves him, but in order for him to be saved, he has to promise to save her mother, who lives in Hackensack, New Jersey, which is where the second missile's going. The first one's going to, you know, the fault in San Andreas. During this whole thing, you know, Superman saves California from being broken off into the sea, but he's not in time to rescue Lois, who actually dies, which is pretty amazing. It's a real heavy-duty moment where her dead body comes up and so on and so forth, but then we get the part of this, and actually he does this in the sequel too, like he does it both times, where the ridiculous thing of him flying around the Earth to reverse its spin, which somehow reverses time, talk about a deus ex machina, like this is like the ultimate deus ex machina that you could probably create for anything. And again, part of the danger of writing Superman is exactly this kind of thing, is that he can pretty much get out of anything. He doesn't have to deal with death. You know, the fact that he, earlier in this film, he had to deal with his father's death, he's like young Anakin. Like, he's like, no, I'll never deal with this kind of death again. And so he, you know, does this thing where he reverses time so he can have everything he wants. And again, there's no stakes for the character with this. It's just like a very storybook ending. But again, you know, this was before the darkening of the landscape. This film does a lot of things right, and it's in earnest in a lot of great ways. You know, there's just a lot of really comic booky, campy, you know, not well thought out stuff in it as well. And definitely this is one of it. Just want to take a quick minute to let you know a couple of ways you can support Sci-Fi on Screen. One way is to use Patreon. Patreon is a crowdfunding site that works by allowing users to contribute on a show-by-show basis. All you do is choose a dollar amount you want to contribute, and every time one of my podcasts appears, you'll be debited the amount you choose. You can donate as little as $1 per show. That's $4 a month, or $52 a year. No obligation, and you can cancel or adjust the rate at any time. And the best part is it keeps me honest. If there's no show, there's no charge. And it would help to defray hosting costs and for my time to put the shows together. The link is on my website, top right-hand corner, and signing up at Patreon is a snap by clicking on Become a Patron. There's also a great way as if you would like to buy the Blu-ray copies of any of the movies that I've reviewed on my podcast. Just simply go to the website, click on the movie page, and go ahead and click on the Blu-ray below the podcast, and it'll take you right to Amazon. If you purchase it, I get a few bucks from that as well. And always appreciate it if you're on Twitter to retweet my podcast as they appear and spread the word. So let me wrap up Man of Steel. As I said earlier, there's a plot of Clark ending up on a fishing boat at one point in his life, and he's just kind of a drifter. But he ends up in this northern sort of Arctic place where he hires on as like one of the workers for this contracting company that's working for the military, and they've just unearthed this extraterrestrial craft. So all of this is like, we're not told in the film if he sensed it was there, he knew it was there, how he gets there. Some unknown drifter guy somehow gets a job at one of the most sensitive military installations in the world with no background, no history. You know what I mean? Like, he's just there. So somehow in this, again, another part of this film that I don't love is somehow in this incredible sensitive military base, Lois Lane is there from the Daily Planet. Like, they would ever allow a reporter anywhere near something like this. So again, to have, you know, Kal-El there, to have her there, it's completely for the script. Out at night, of course, no one is guarding anything there, so Lois Lane can kind of go down an ice shelf and sneak into the ship. Cal's already there. You know, he has heat visioned his way in by making a tunnel in the ice, which is kind of cool. When he gets in, he inserts that little metal rod that we had seen earlier, and the ship powers up, and a hologram of his father appears, which I guess was in that little metal sliver, because, you know, why would a hologram of Jor-El be in this ancient seed ship? We see some hibernation pods. One has a corpse in it. You know, Lois is taking pictures, and she gets hurt. One of these sort of robots on the ship hurts her, and Cal cauterizes her wound with his heat vision. And so, you know, she's completely aware that he's this being that's probably connected to the ship somewhere. The ship rises and flies off with Cal in it, and she's left behind. It's a weird intro, how they meet and that they're both up there, and it's just really odd. I don't quite buy it. As the story continues to unfold, I'm just left kind of like, how did that happen? You know, we get a quick Daily Planet. You know, we meet Perry White, played by Lawrence Fishburne, who's great. Lois wants this story to be printed about Clark. Perry thinks it's complete speculation. He's not printing a story about aliens. The Pentagon has denied it, so on and so forth. So now Lois is on a quest to track him down, and winds up tracking him to Smallville. You know, we see a montage of her like interviewing some of the people we've seen earlier while Clark was drifting. Clark shows up in Smallville and confronts her as Superman, not with his glasses, you know. So she knows who he is straight away, which is great because they can avoid the whole glasses thing, at least for her, who's seen him, you know, for a long time up close. I don't know how they're going to deal with it in the sequels. But what's good is he convinces her that, you know, my father died believing that the world wasn't ready for me to emerge. And I would like you to respect his wishes and my wishes. And so Lois, she goes on board. And so earlier, she had leaked her story to some, you know, blogger, and Perry found out about it and flipped out. When she comes back, all of a sudden, she makes a turn. And she's like, "Oh, you're right, Perry. I'm not gonna back up the story. I'm gonna deny I've leaked it." And then Perry lets in that, "Well, okay, if you're doing that, then it must be true, and you have reasons of your own." It's a subtle little play in the office. I kind of like it. Then this is the last bit. This is the whole General Zod taking over the world story, and because no one has learned what a terrible actor Harry Lennox was in the two Matrix sequels as Commander Locke, he's been rehired, barking his way through the screen, you know, as, I don't know, I'm sure he's a really nice guy, but I never really liked his performances in the Matrix films, and I don't like him in this. He's just kind of stiff, you know. They discover an alien ship orbiting the moon. There's all kinds of UFO sightings, and there's actually a great moment when Zod's ship enters atmosphere, and it's on fully being videoed. At the Daily Planet, everyone's gathered around the TV screens. And it's a really cool, it's kind of 9/11-ish. I really like it. It's like, for a minute there, they really get at like what it might feel like to witness such a momentous occasion. So it's very cool. And the craft is dropping near Smallville. And we do this global montage for Scope, news of this it goes around the world. And we see like every culture is tuning in and looking at this incredible ship, which is pretty amazing. Then we get a weird visual of like not quite a face on a screen, and in every language on the globe, it's told that one of their races is hiding on Earth, and then he needs to give himself up, or that the world will suffer some serious consequences. So right away, you know, Zod is like, we don't hear how he's escaped the Phantom Zone or how he's here in any way. He's just, here he is, and, you know, the bad guy has arrived. Back in Smallville, this is, you know, Clark's moment. First we get a flashback of him with a bunch of kids at one point, and they're kind of bullying him when he's like a young man, and they want him to fight back, and he doesn't. And, you know, the kids walk away. You know, this scene is there because the next scene is going to be there, right? It's like the theme of him surrendering to mankind and trusting them. So, you know, him as a child not fighting back because he would kill the kids who were pushing him around, you know, that he needs to, you know, to trust. So then there's this really solid story moment where Clark walks into a church. We get a sense it's a Christian church. We don't know what the denomination is. And he's talking with a pastor. And he's like, I don't know what to do. You know, I know this guy's odd can't be trusted, that even if I turn myself over to them, I don't trust for a minute that the earth is still going to be safe. I don't know if I can trust human beings. And, you know, the guy's basically like, you got to take a leap of faith. And I think it's great. So I really like it. He surrenders to mankind, not to Zod, which is kind of cool. And has this conversation with Lois in an underground bunker, which is kind of cool. She's about to say the word Superman when there's like feedback from the mic. So it's interrupted, which I think is very clever. And Lois is not going to reveal his identity because she knows he's Clark Kent, which is great. And the U.S. military, unfortunately, does plan to hand him over to Zod. They don't really have much of a choice. So we get a scout ship from Zod's vessel. And they also request Lois to go with him. It's like, we want Lois to come too. And there's absolutely no reason why Lois is needed on this ship. It's just, you know, it's going to be a plot of Lois rescuing Superman. So I don't know. It's kind of goofy. Before he goes, though, he gives Lois the little sliver, which we think is the Codex. It's also the Jor-El AI. He gives it to Lois as he walks on board. And then they do this thing where it's not so much the red sun, yellow sun thing. Some of it is, but it's the atmosphere. They start talking about when Clark was a young boy. As a baby, he really had a difficult time breathing Earth's atmosphere. But over time, you know, he grew accustomed to it. So Zod and the other members of his crew need to wear these masks, these breathing masks when they're in Earth's atmosphere. And when Cal goes on Zod's ship, he becomes very weak. So there's something where like something in the Kryptonian atmosphere weakens him to the point where he's kind of like a normal human being. So it's just, I don't know, it's a weird thing, but it is what it is. He's now captive. He has very little super strength. You know, they have him in her captivity. Lois is able to insert the Jor-El AI into the ship's mainframe that it uploads itself. And so like Jor-El via his AI self guides her to Superman. And he's already changing the atmosphere to help Cal get away. So this is a whole thing where, you know, Cal's able to fly away. You know, Jor-El gets Lois to a pod and she blasts off. And of course, he saves her and they're off the ship. We do get the backstory about Zod and that the destruction of Krypton destroyed the Phantom Zone projector. So freeing them, that they have been surveying all the old colonial outposts. And again, Michael Shannon as Zod here is very flat. It's kind of like chewing the scenery, but nothing much exciting about it. When Cal activated the old scout ship, it emitted a distress signal, which then was picked up by Zod, and that's how Zod found Earth, which is clever. I get that. You know, that's pretty cool. So, of course, he's after the Codex. There's a Genesis chamber on the scout ship, and with the Genesis chamber and the Codex, they can pretty much grow an entire new race of beings and terraform Earth fairly quickly to host their new race. So we kind of get what's going to happen to our good old planet. So now we get our first confrontation between Zod and his crew and Kal-El in Smallville. They've tracked him down to Smallville. They're sort of bracing Martha Kent, and they throw this truck into the house, destroying it. Part of what I really do like about the last bit of Man of Steel is the effects work in terms of the fights. To me, it's kind of interesting because there's a film called Chronicle that was released several years before this film came out, and Chronicle was sort of a mid-budget film done about superheroes. It was a found footage superhero film, which I covered in a previous podcast if you want to go check it out. But what they did with Chronicle, which was great, was they filmed the realistic effects in the frame of what would then be painted in a special effects shot. So what am I talking about? They would shoot like a real object going through a real window, and then later on they would paint in you know, a figure flying through it, right? So they do this a lot also in Man of Steel, which is great. So there's not a ton of special effects in terms of the whole scene being a special effect. It's just the figures flying. And to me, it adds so much to the realism of these fights. Because, you know, again, a tough thing about Superman films, right, the flying fights, and that you risk it just being a bunch of CGI zooming around the screen, which is very boring. They really take a page from the Chronicle here, and it's very effective, where it really feels like they're doing real-world effects, deforming houses and smashing sides of buildings. And then they later in, all they have to do is sort of CGI in the flying body, and it looks awesome. And so the fight scenes in this film are really amazing. This initial one, Superman gets the best of General Zod. He crushes his helmet, and he finds it almost impossible to breathe. And he's rescued by his people. The U.S. military is also in on the action here as well. And again, you know, it's not overly cut. It's not overly jittery or steady-cammy, which, you know, obviously they could have gone as well. I feel like the action sequences of the fights are really great. There's a great scene at the end of the fight when the U.S. military, you know, they all drop their weapons because during the fight, you know, he's protected them also. Not only fighting against the Kryptonians, but he's protected the military guys from getting killed by them as well. So they kind of get a sense that he's on our side. And we hear the main guy, I think it's Harry Lennox in the scene where he says, "This man is not our enemy." So it's a good scene. It's a good emotional hit. Then we get the big, you know, Avengers-style movie ender. The information that the Codex is in Cal's cells, you know. So at the beginning of the movie, when we saw the skull disintegrate, it was actually the Codex was integrated into Cal's body. So it doesn't have to be alive for Zod to retrieve all of the data, but it's all bonded to his cellular structure. We get the whole, you know, world engine, Galactus, I'm sorry. We get the whole world engine plot where, you know, Zod's ship breaks in two when it goes to the other side of the world, and they do this whole gravity wave between the two of them, and somehow that's also going to change the atmosphere. You know, it's basically a terraforming thing, and the effects are really cool because near where the ships are, the gravity is kind of cutting out and kicking back in and cutting out and smashing things to pieces. And really, you know, really, it's modern day 21st century film effects, really, really cool. Zod also steals the original colony ship, which has the Genesis pod, so he's all ready to go. He's going to terraform the planet, use the Codex if he can find it, and get it out of Cal's body and repopulate Earth as like new Krypton. There's a couple of battles here. Cal goes to the other side of the world to destroy one half of the world engine, and its defense mechanism is like these silver tentacled creatures that come after him, and it's a pretty boring fight. And when he destroys the one half of it, the half in Metropolis then loses its shielding, so they drop what's left of the little pod that Cal came to Earth in, and supposedly the phantom drive merges with the phantom drive on Zod's ship, creates a little black hole, and sucks the whole ship in. So, you know, it's a win-win. Then there's a final battle between Superman and General Zod. You know, at this point in the film, I've definitely got battle fatigue. Like, there's been so much going on. So the two of them fighting, it goes on a little bit longer than, you know, that I'd want to, but again, the effects are really good, and they have this ending scene where, you know, Superman realizes that Zod will never stop, and he breaks his neck and kills him. And I go back and forth on this. I mean, you know, the big thing about Superman, like Batman, is that they have this ethic where they just don't kill, you know, and it makes them more interesting as characters, because sometimes killing opponents is such an easy way out that it gives the character more drama when they can't just go ahead and kill their opponent and they have to, you know, try to nullify them without killing them, which makes it sometimes a little more fun to watch. So I don't know. You know, what they didn't do here in the film is set up that Superman has a no-kill ethos, right? When you watch Batman Begins, I mean, they set up the no-kill ethos in Batman in the beginning. Like in Batman Begins, there's a scene in the beginning of the film where, in order to graduate from the League of Shadows training camp, he has to behead a common thief, and he won't do it. And he basically says to Ra's al Ghul, it's what separates us from them. That's why it's so important. Later on, when he doesn't kill, you know why, and it makes sense to his character. Whereas, you know, obviously in Superman, it's just become an accepted part of his character that he doesn't kill, but they don't address that fact here. I mean, they do, you know, they do part of it when he's getting bullied as a child, or even, you know, later on when he gets bullied a little bit by a guy in a diner, he winds up, you know, destroying the guy's truck, not him. So there is a sense of restraint. So they don't really address it. So him killing a fellow Kryptonian, I guess when I first saw it, it really bugged the hell out of me. And I thought, oh, they're really messing around with the character. But at the end of the day, you know, we'll see where the character goes in Batman v Superman and how they're going to, if they're going to deal with this, or if he's really remorseful about it and it really plays into his character being kind of a brooding type of character, maybe it's a really good thing, you know? So I don't know. I kind of go back and forth about it. Part of me also thinks that Zod was the last Kryptonian. And so some of his anguish is that he was forced to kill the last of his own people as well. So again, you know, it's all about what they're going to do in the sequels. If this is going to play into it at all, or they're just going to drop the whole thing. And at the very last bit, there's a really lovely coda in this film of Clark when he was really, really young, playing with like a red cape in the yard and putting his fists on his hips, Jonathan and Martha watching. And this is coming from a conversation that he's having with Martha, you know, in present day. And Hans Zimmer's piano cue is there, and it's really, really great. It's just really, you know, there are certain moments in this film that are really emotional and really terrific. And then at the end of the movie, you get his first day at the Daily Planet. And the good thing about this is he comes in, he's got the glasses on, right? But Lois knows it's him. So, and he hasn't been up close with too many people. So, you know, it's still going to be a tricky thing to handle. But I feel like I like the fact that Lois knows it's him. So you don't have to work around that. What would be a fairly ridiculous notion. So that ends Man of Steel. So, you know, and overall, to compare the two films, I like the Krypton sequence a little bit better in the original film. Smallville, both films, I think, have really great moments. There's a lot of unwatchable stuff in the Richard Donner Superman now. You know, there's a lot of stuff that's really hokey. It doesn't play. The whole Luthor story, really, really hard to sit through and really, really boring. You know, the Marvel Universe really has shown us how you can do comedy and drama in a superhero film, you know, and they do it really well. Whedon, obviously, is the best at it. But it's really camp in this film, in the first Superman film, for sure. And the turning back time at the end is just a really cheap deus ex machina, which cheapens a lot, you know. So to me, I don't think Superman stands as a whole film. I don't think it stands that well. There are parts in it that are great. I think it stands apart in that it started so many things, and it was the first to try to do serious actors in the role. It's first to try to take it seriously. So it deserves a ton of credit. And it's so earnest in its depiction of things. You know, like it's not cynical in any way. Even the comedy bits with Luther, it's more campy than anything else. So it's a very earnest attempt to do a Superman film. I just think some parts of it are really, really dated. And Man of Steel is a mixed bag for me too. It's funny, on repeated viewings, They do so much lens flare here. It makes J.J. Abrams look like he never did it. Like it's like the lens flare movie. It's unbelievable. The opening Krypton sequence is overstuffed. I don't think it's very good. I really love the Smallville stuff with Cal. I love Cal as the drifter. You know, I love those sequences. They play in one scene when Cal's drifting a Chris Cornell scene. So it kind of gets a little gritty, and he has a beard. So there's some grittiness to it. The fight scenes in Man of Steel are really amazing, just really well done. Bodes well for Batman v Superman, you know. The Smallville sequences, like I said, I really, really love. But, you know, that last world domination, Zod world engine stuff kicks in. Like, I kind of go to sleep. It's a little overclocked. So I feel like neither film is really a home run completely. They both have their strengths. They both have their weaknesses. I'm really curious to see, you know, what's going to happen in Batman v Superman and how they're going to continue to play the character, because to me, Superman is a fascinating character. He's just such a weird anachronism of like these, you know, these gee whiz 50s values. And they still, you know, it's like Captain America. They still bring that stuff forward. And how do you do that in a, you know, as our world changes and as our values change as the years go by. So it's just a very fascinating character to play with. And so I'm going to release this on the day that Batman v Superman Dawn of Justice is released. So I wish all of you a fun time at the theater. I'm probably going to try to get to see it this weekend, and I will report back on it when it comes on Blu-ray. So that's all I have to say about Superman Original versus Remake.
Thanks once again for listening to Sci-Fi on Screen, to my returning listeners and new listeners alike. If you like what you heard, head on over to iTunes and give us a review. We'd love to hear from you. If you have any suggestions about the show, you can send an email to scifionscreen@gmail.com. Or feel free to leave a comment on the website, www.scifionscreen.com, and you can leave a comment in the comments section of the show page. If you'd like to support SciFiOnScreen.com, you can go to patreon.com/SciFiOnScreen. And that's Patreon is P-A-T-R-E-O-N. And to make it easy on yourself, there is a button on the webpage that you can click. Patreon is set up so you can pick an amount you want to contribute per episode, and it'll be recurring. If you'd like to do that, that is available. We'd appreciate all the support we can get. And you can find us, again, our website, www.scifionscreen.com. We have a Facebook page, and on any smartphone, you could search for us on the podcast app and subscribe. Thanks again. See you next time.